Donna Tartt's 2013 book, The Goldfinch, won a Pulitzer Prize for its story of a boy whose mother dies in a bombing. It is an epic tale of grief, abandonment, friendship, drugs, and a stolen painting of a goldfinch. Now, The Goldfinch has been adapted into a movie starring Ansel Elgort, Oakes Fegley, Nicole Kidman, Luke Wilson, Jeffrey Wright, Finn Wolfhard, and Sarah Paulson. I'm Stephen Thompson. This week on Pop Culture Happy Hour from NPR, we are talking The Goldfinch, both the movie and the book that spawned it. Here with me in the studio is Barry Hardiman, who is the books editor for Weekend Edition. Hello, Barry.
Hi.
It is a pleasure to have you here. Also with us is writer Katie Presley. Hello, Katie.
Howdy.
Hi there. And also joining us, writer Chris Klimek. Hello, Chris.
I've seen Goldfinger 100 times. I'm so excited to talk about it.
So I'm not going to start with you, Chris. I'll give you a couple minutes to regroup. I'm going to start with Barry. You've read the book.
I have.
And you've seen the movie.
I have.
What'd you think?
Well, I will say that this movie suffers from something that I think often happens when you try to maybe be just slightly too faithful to in terms of a literary adaptation. The book, which is a doorstop of a book and has so many places and plot points, if you reduce it down to its plot points, it becomes a very and then this and then this and then this and then this. And the movie to me felt very plot, 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 plot. Here's a lovely actor. Plot, 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 plot. And there are ways in which, you know, as you read the list of actors in it and I heard Ansel Elgort, Oakes Fegley, I thought, well, that sounds like a more interesting movie because like it sort of lost some of its Dickensian feel of the book because it seems to me. Maybe you had a director who wanted to be just so faithful to the book that he neglected to tell the real story of the book, which I think you can do and lose truly like maybe half of the plot, which in some ways is maybe how I felt about the book. I think Donna Tartt is marvelous. I am a huge Secret History fan, and this is a hard one to do.
Well, you're telling this story that spans a number of years and that involves a lot of characters being played by multiple actors. Mm-hmm. Unless you are Nicole Kidman, your role is split between...
Who will only do a role if she can play a 40-year span in a character's life.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So you know, this is a sprawling story. So to summarize a little bit of that plot, there's a boy named Theo. He is at a museum with his mom. The museum is bombed. His mother dies. And Theo winds up taking a painting from the museum. And that painting has an impact on his life as the movie follows him through his childhood and his young adulthood. So there's a lot of character development to pack into this story, and it sort of follows the fate of this kid and of this painting. Katie, what'd you think?
A dark secret about me as a reader is I really am not generous with morally questionable characters. Mm-hmm. So I think in order to be an intelligent reader, you're supposed to appreciate morally ambiguous or even morally repugnant characters because they're interesting. I can't stand them. I'm a nice person, right? Like doula in the streets, apparently a-hole in the sheets of a book.
Yes.
So
the leaves of a book.
Don't write it on a bathroom wall, guys.
So what made the book interesting to me was that the central question of the book is a question of moral ambiguity. Like a boy who is very recently concussed, has just been the victim of a terrorist attack, plucks a painting out of a museum because he thinks he's supposed to because a dying man has told him to. And then as he gets older, he realizes sort of what he's done, and it becomes a dark web kind of closing in on him, what he's done, and the sorts of people who want in on what he's done. Somehow, the movie didn't capture that complexity to the character of Theo. I'm very judgy of unlikable characters, is the pithy way of saying it. That is a fundamental part of who Theo is, that the way that he processes the trauma of losing his mother and being in that explosion is by getting into some really shady stuff. And I think the Elgort performance manages to lose that, mm-hmm. but also doesn't gain any charisma. Mm-hmm. So it felt like a very flat performance to me, and that performance is central to that. You have to care about him if you're going to care about this story. He's the one that makes you believe that the painting is magical. He's the one that makes you believe that the object of his affection is a Helen of Troy, like, worth all affection, and that his caretaker is as benevolent as he is. There's so much magic that the book has time to expand upon through Theo's eyes that the movie didn't give you. So I came out feeling, gosh, that was awfully pretty. Gosh, I'm glad I read that gorgeous book. Gosh, why?
Also, I'm hungry. It was long.
Yeah.
That was the last thing I felt.
Yeah.
Hunger. This is what you came out of this movie with. All right. How about you, Chris?
Yeah, I didn't quite finish the novel before I saw the movie because it is a few pages shy of 800 pages. So it is about three times the length of a typical novel. So even a 2.5-hour movie is a very hurried, very condensed adaptation of this. I think I agree with Katie's macro critique of how the movie tells the story and loses nearly all the subtext. I sort of thought I would enjoy that more because Theo is the narrator of the novel, and we get a little bit of voiceover from him in the film, but not very much. You're not in his head, you know, living with his perceptions the way you are for every word of this, again, 800-page book. I think this movie needed a director with a more deft hand at combining time periods. This is a film and a novel that jumps back and forth between when our narrator is 13 and when he's, I don't know, 28 or 30 or something. Christopher Nolan is a director who does this really well. Sorry, I know I'm always the person defending the Chris Nolan movie in this corner, but
he might have found a way to make it even longer.
That's not fair.
Dunkirk
was under 2 hours, but that thing that this film attempts, where we're making the something that is chronologically prior to most of what we've seen feel like the emotional climax of the film. That is the kind of card trick that he can pull off. And this director,
John Crowley,
who made Brooklyn, which I like very much, but that's it's a much simpler story. It's linear. I don't mean to diminish her or Saoirse Ronan's performance, but I mean, she's not morally conflicted in the way that Ansel Elgort, that Theo is in this movie. I think that's a great adaptation. This just, it feels hammy, plotting, kind of workmanlike. I think it diminishes the book.
Yeah, I had somewhat of the same reaction. One thing that I kept thinking throughout this movie was, why is this a movie? And not, and I don't mean like, why is this a movie? Like, why does this exist? I'm not sitting there with my arms folded, but I'm thinking, why isn't this, and this is going to sound counterintuitive, why isn't this an 8-hour miniseries?
Yeah. Yeah.
Why isn't this, I mean, this is Amazon Studios. They could have made this as a long form TV project, you know, and given the filmmakers time to draw out these characters a little bit better. This is an epic story. This is a 773-page book. This is a 2.5-hour movie. And the movie somehow feels both rushed and slow. And that's a really tough combination because they're racing through all these plot machinations. And I just kept sitting there thinking, and it felt longer than 2.5 hours. I just kept sitting there thinking, I don't feel like I'm getting to know these characters. I can tell we're a long way from the ending. Mm-hmm. And yet at the same time, it weirdly doesn't feel like anything's happening, even though there's so much plot. I found the experience of watching the movie to be really frustrating. As much as it is beautifully shot, I think there are some lovely performances in it. I think it's very nicely cast. I think Oakes Fegley as young Theo
was phenomenal.
He was also in Pete's Dragon, which is what I like. I know I've heard the name Oakes Fegley before. I think he's terrific. I think Finn Wolfhard as Theo's Ukrainian best friend that he meets when he has been transported to the horrors of the outskirts of Las Vegas. You know, he meets this kid, Boris, played by Finn Wolfhard, you know, who has that really thick accent. And I'm so used to seeing Finn Wolfhard in the It movies or in Stranger Things. But I thought that was a strangely lovely performance, a really affecting performance. I liked the child actors in this a little bit more than some of the grown-up performances.
Definitely.
There are all these little components of it that I like. It's shot by Roger Deakins, who's an amazing cinematographer.
Yeah. I was kind of astounded when his credit came up at the end because this is not a movie that, I mean, it's mostly indoors. It doesn't have the kind of big vistas of movies like Blade Runner, which he finally won his Oscar for, or Sicario or the Coen Brothers movies he's made. But I was surprised because this felt like TV for me and not, you know, not prestige TV necessarily, kind of.
Well, I think, I think that's
80s network TV.
Ouch.
I mean, I do think that's part of it. Is it did feel like it had the tone of like a Big Little Lies, you know, type story, and partly because it had Nicole Kidman, but like it felt like it should be on TV.
I think that's right because the book itself is also incredibly episodic. You know, you do have, and she does this. I mean, this is a very Secret History, Little Friend kind of thing to do, where she is interested in the interplay of these different worlds, of being in the busy, you know, the teeming space of New York and the Upper East Side, and then being in this wasteland of Las Vegas, and then being the places you go in her books, and the way that, like, class and place and person rub up against each other is very important. And again, every idea in this movie feels very unfinished. He obviously understood that thing about class that she's talking about. He understood the thing about, you know, first impression and art and how trauma plays. But everything only gets a glancing blow. And had it been, you know, here is the episode with Boris in Amsterdam, here is the episode with Boris in, you know, in Las Vegas, I think you would have gotten a little more of that. And, you know, what would have been really nice is, you know, because the book doesn't really have a, doesn't land the plane, really. You're really just sort of circling over a philosophy rather than a plot ending. You would have given the viewer more time to develop it on their own. So I walked out feeling sort of confused, and I didn't have that feeling of, you know, even though I did feel that the book's ending is unfinished, I still felt that I'd had an experience of all these things. There was a lot to talk about. There was a lot to think about. I did not feel this here, except there was a lot to love in the apartment. I do want to just shout out
oh my gosh,
to Hobie, well, Hobie A, but also Hobie's apartment. Beautiful.
I liked all the apartments, actually. I liked the glimpses you got of the apartment that Theo lived in with his mother, and the Barbers. So the Barbers are the wealthy family that first take Theo in immediately after the explosion. Andy Barber is a friend of Theo's, a classmate. They were closer as young boys than they are now, but they take him in. And Mrs. Barber is played by Nicole Kidman, who, I gotta say, I'm not a Nicole Kidman person. And so I think one of the places that this movie faltered for me is she was like a black hole, and the camera just rested on her face gazing at Theo thoughtfully. And I was like, this is wasted time.
This is not an idea.
this is
a shot.
Right, exactly. Yes. And like, that's so much of how she acts. She acts through her cheekbones. Those are the antenna. You know, you're watching them for her reaction and just like the little movements at the corner of her mouth. And I don't actually find that very interesting. I'm a cheekbony person. I like a good cheekbone, but it felt contractual. It felt like Ms. Kidman requires no fewer than 15 minutes of close-up on cheek, you know? And the character, both in the, I will say this is true, in the book and the movie, opens up.
Significantly.
In her older age. Her family encounters major tragedy that compounds the sympathy that she was already forming for Theo. But when we're talking about these weird drops into melodrama, it like added melodrama that was not necessary, because the story could be dramatic if you let it breathe a little bit more. So like, too much time on Kidman. She did not work for me. I did actually like her at her oldest age in the movie, but I just saw all of her performances written on top of each other. I saw Virginia Woolf in there.
She's becoming rich white lady.
She felt like a close match of the way that Tart describes the character, but you don't have to do it exactly the way Tart describes the character. You can cast someone else.
Exactly.
You can go a different direction. You know, you can still, an adaptation is not a straight translation.
Right.
I do want to say one thing, because if people do not want to see this movie, which I would certainly understand after this conversation, I will say the book itself is one of those wonderfully meandering tales that actually benefits from the time you spend reading it. You know, you dip into it for a new episode, and the writing is absolutely incandescent. The descriptions of the furniture, the look at Las Vegas, even the descriptions of some of the emotions, like the tears that fall out of his face that are unconnected to emotion. I mean, there are all of these moments in the book that really stick with you. And I will say, I do think it is absolutely worth whatever time you put in to this book, too. So
I agree.
I just, you know.
Nice. We want to know what you think about The Goldfinch. If you are one of the, I'm sure, hundreds of millions of people who flocked to the theater this weekend to see it, find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH or tweet us at PCHH. When we come back, it'll be time to talk about what's making us happy this week. So come right back.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Zoom. When you can't be there in person, Zoom. Zoom is used by millions to connect face-to-face, across town or around the world. Share files, video, anything, and connect through any device, desktop, laptop, tablet, smartphone, or conference room system. Zoom Video Conferencing, Zoom Rooms, Zoom Video Webinars, and Zoom Phone lets you do business at the speed of Zoom. Visit Zoom online to set up your free account today. Meet happy with Zoom.
Support also comes from The RealReal, the leading reseller of authenticated luxury items. Shop luxury clothing, accessories, and fine art at unreal prices. From your favorite designers like Louis Vuitton, Gucci, Cartier, and hundreds more. And The RealReal authenticates each item to ensure it's guaranteed authentic. Shop in-store, on the app, or at TheRealReal.com and receive 20% off select items with promo code REAL.
Welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. It is time for our favorite segment of this week and every week. What is making us happy this week? Barry Hardiman, what is making you happy this week?
This is a really great couple of weeks for new graphic novels for middle graders that are coming out. And I just wanted to name check a few that I think are so wonderful. So the first I want to talk about is Raina Telgemeier.
She's great.
The most fabulous, who, you know, has done a string of illustrations of the Babysitter's Club books, which are obviously wonderful on their own, but also really wonderful illustrated by her. And then she has her own series of books, Ghosts, Drama.
Drama's great.
Oh, I love drama. And I love drama. But it's great. And she has her new book. It's called Guts. And it is another in this trilogy of Smile and Sisters. And this one is about anxiety. And it is, as a mom who is familiar with anxiety, both of my own and truly everyone in my house, I will say it is so great to see this particular thing illustrated on the page with so much honesty and humor and normalcy. I just love it. So Guts is fabulous. And then the other one I want to talk about is, I don't know if we've ever talked about Shannon Hale, but she wrote the wonderful Princess in Black books, which are truly great first chapter books for boys and girls. My boys adored them. She has a slightly sort of more middle-aged, middle-graded book series. The first one is called Real Friends, and it's sort of her journey through sixth grade. And the next one is called Best Friends, and I believe it is out this week. Both of them are illustrated beautifully by Le Guin Pham, and they kind of have a freaks and geeks quality to them, that, you know, in a public school in Utah. And the way that these girls treat each other is, you know, as often girls will treat each other, horrifying. But it is so, it is done in such a beautiful way. And I will say, like, first of all, I read them in one sitting. I find them propulsive. I have two boys. They love these books. They love to talk about the friendships. I love that I am discussing all of these issues through the lives of these girls. There's something about it that
totally
is so wonderful. The drawings are gorgeous. So go on out there, get Real Friends, Best Friends by Shannon Hale, and Raina Telgemeier's newest, Guts.
Thank you very much, Barry Hardiman. Katie Presley, what's making you happy this week?
I brought for us today Pressure Cooker, a book by Sarah Bowen, Jocelyn Brenton, and Sanika Elliott. The subtitle is Why Home Cooking Won't Solve Our Problems and What We Can Do About It. I'm just starting it, but I'm really excited. So this book is nonfiction. Maybe you can call it investigative. I don't know. It's deeply embedded, deeply researched. So the authors embed with 9 families and talk to them about their relationship to feeding their families. I'm interested in every part of this. I'm interested in the micro story of 9 different women. They are all women talking about how they feed their families. I'm also interested in the macro of a book that is interested in an equitable food system that still nourishes our kids and how difficult that is to do. I love that this book is going to dive into the fact that it's actually super hard to be smart and conscientious about feeding your family, no matter what your resources are. And so obviously, perhaps not obviously, but these 9 families are facing very different things in feeding their children. So some face really tight budgets, all face bad or conflicting nutrition information. All are also operating under different intersections of the burdens of race and gender and income and even nationality, you know, what foods are readily available to buy. So there's just a lot to dig into here. And I'm so glad that someone did. And I'm glad they did it through parents. I'm super excited, super grateful this book exists. Pressure cooker.
Thank you, Katie Pressley. Chris Klimek, what's making you happy this week?
I was in Santa Fe, in New Mexico, the land of enchantment last week, a high elevation, dry, sunny state with no tall buildings outside of Albuquerque where cowboy hats are a necessity, not a vanity item. Excellent state. I recommend it. Specifically, there is a facility called the Meow Wolf in Santa Fe. Used to be a bowling alley. This is the permanent art installation and performance venue used by a collective of artists that goes by the same name. I had to write down Meow Wolf because I have called it a lot of different combinations of words. You know, Meow Kitty, lots of things. Yes, Wolf Like Me. But this is a group of artists that was not feeling accepted in the sort of entrenched Santa Fe, you know, high-end gallery scene. They wanted to do their own thing, and they finally decided to make their own space. They got a wealthy patron in George R. R. Martin, who is either the Beatles producer or a guy who wrote some Dragon books that got turned into an HBO show. What they have turned this bowling alley into is truly stunning. You know, I've done a lot of non-linear immersive theater shows and, you know, Sleep No More and things like that, where you're encouraged to wander around and everything is part of the set design and you're supposed to open cabinets and go through drawers and try to solve the mystery based on what you pull out of. This is the only one of those that has left me feeling satisfied.
not bamboozled.
Not like I just missed something or I did it wrong. The name of the permanent exhibition, which comprises a magical house that is full of secret passages for you to explore and portals to other dimensions, is the House of Eternal Return. But there is also a performance venue in the space where I saw a burlesque show that also had a mariachi band and a puppeteer
a
stand-up comedian. Yeah, it was
vapor
it was
trail
really...
as I leave the studio.
Yeah, so I think I paid $35 to get into a Meow Wolf in Santa Fe, which included my ticket to the show. Well worth it. If you find yourself in Santa Fe, you should check it out.
Thank you very much, Chris Klimek. For me, if you, like me, have been experiencing a lot of anxiety lately for whatever reason, I cannot highly enough recommend a new album called Like the River Loves the Sea. And I know Katie will co-sign this. It is by a Kentucky singer-songwriter named Joan Shelley, who works with, among other people, the wonderful guitarist Nathan Salzberg. Once you're done with Joan Shelley's five albums, go over to Nathan Salzberg's records, watch both of their Tiny Desk concerts. There is so much gentle, rustic beauty to soak up. This album, Like the River Loves the Sea, is specifically engineered. Joan Shelley herself has said that she wanted this album to be, and I quote, a haven for overstimulated heads in uncertain times. Reader, she nailed it.
I have one of those heads.
It is, yes, yeah. It is such a calming and beautiful, sweet, gentle sound. Actually, let's hear a little bit of the song High on the Mountain.
I'm high on the mountain, looking out over fields at the vines and the flowers, so entwined, just as you and I used to be.
As you can hear, Joan Shelley has this gorgeous voice, these beautiful acoustic arrangements. For this album, she brought in strings. She recorded it in Iceland.
Iceland, please. That's a bit much.
A little on the nose.
It's a little on the nose. It is so gorgeous. Please spend time with all of her music. It always makes me feel usually better, always calmer. She is a treasure. Mm-hmm. Joan Shelley, Like the River Loves the Sea. And that brings us to the end of our show. You can find all of us on Twitter. You can find me at I Dislike Steven. You can follow Barry at B Hardiman. You can follow Katie at Love Is Maroon and Chris at CT Klimek. That's CTKLIMEK. You can follow our producer, Jessica Reedy at Jessica_Reedy, and our producer emeritus and music director, Mike Katziff at Mike Katziff. That's KATZIF. Mike's band Hello Come In provides the music you are bobbing your head to right now. Thanks to all of you for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour from NPR. And if you have a second and you're so inclined, please subscribe to our newsletter at npr.org/popculturenewsletter. We will see you all right back here next week.
When you think of country music, you probably have a particular image in mind. But as you can imagine, the history is way more complicated.
This week on Throughline, we sit down with filmmaker Ken Burns to talk about his new documentary about the origins of country music.
Throughline from NPR, the podcast where we go back in time
to understand the present.